welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As always, our conversations include you. If you'd like to join us tonight during the program, our phone number is 941-3689. That's the number to use if you call us from Oahu and from the neighbor islands. Or if you're listening to the live stream someplace else, you can get to us at 877-941-3689. We have just a few days left before Election Day, even fewer for walk-in voting. That ends on Saturday. In the last of our series of conversations with the gubernatorial candidates, tonight we'll talk with GOP candidate James Duke Iona. We'll look at how he's assessing the race to this point and the issues that he hopes will swing voters his way. If you have a question that you feel hasn't been answered in all the forums that have been done over the last month or so, you're welcome to join us. And if you have just a good luck or an attaboy, as much as we would appreciate that, we can do that privately. We want to make room for the callers to ask issues-based questions. You guys know the drill. Thanks so much for complying. Welcome, Duke Iona.
Aloha.
Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, nice to be here. Thank you.
In looking at some of the issues that you are obviously confronted with, one of the most, I think, upsetting for some and happy for others is the issue of what happens with all the polling. I mean, we were talking about this morning with Chad Blair, and he wrote his article this morning about, you know, why public opinion polls suck. And you're joking with that, even though that he's with an organization that does polling and what polling means. So I thought I'd ask you, how do you assess the polls and what do they really mean to you?
You know, for me, in regards to just the raw numbers, and when I say the raw numbers, I'm talking about the, you know, the head-to-head, you know, election itself. So in other words, myself, David Ige, Mufi Hanneman, and Jeff Davis, I don't pay any attention to it because really it's about the poll on November 4th. What may be of some value are basically the attachments they have to it. In other words, when they ask the questions regarding, you know, your reasons for voting the way you're voting. Is it because of his principles? Is it because of his leadership? And it just gives you an indication of kind of where people are. I think people are more truthful in regards to that than they are to telling you exactly who they're going to vote for. I've had several people who are supporters who have received calls. And there's a lot of polls going on, okay? I mean, it's not just Civil Beat and Hawaii News Now. You have
The CBS poll that was just done virtually the same time as the Civil Beat poll.
And I saw that one, I just saw the numbers, the raw data on that, and we were 32 points down. And I know there's no way we're 32 points down. I can tell you that right now. But in any event, things of those natures, the demographics, I guess, that's what I'm talking about. It just gives me an indication of where people are. And so when I get out there and I start, you know, and I engage with people, whether it be at a meet and greet, at businesses when I walk through, or the other, you know, little meetings that I have with people, it basically steers me towards what I want to hit. I mean, I know what my priority issues are, my main issues are, but it just gives me some indication. So I try to maybe give a little bit more time to that or open up with that issue that I feel that, you know, is
top of mind.
So you
look at it
sort of
as a bellwether of trends and ideas and what people are carrying with them.
But the numbers don't – I mean, again, the numbers are just – it's just – okay, I don't look at 24 or 25. It's just, okay, what's at the top, what's at the bottom? That's what I mean. So I'm not looking at numbers per se.
So what are the trends that you think you're carrying with you as you move from issue to issue and place to place? What are the constants?
I believe that we are resonating in regards to our message of going in a new direction, that – right now, Hawaii is not in balance in regards to government. I believe that our campaign theme, which is trust, respect, and balance, is resonating with the people of Hawaii. I believe the fact that we're talking about cost of living, we're talking about taxes, we're talking about jobs and the economy and education is exactly what people want to hear. So when I let them know that we have a platform that is a solution to these issues, it resonates. I mean, I get great feedback with that. So, you know, one of the issues is about, you know, basically, I wouldn't say affordable housing. Let's just say housing in general.
Okay, before you get into that, because I want to ask you, many of the issues you just talked about are the perennial ones that usually surface year in, year out.
Exactly.
And many candidates, as you do, talk about those issues. But really, a governor is one person. And you can have lots of issues, lots of promises, and one fulfill those, but you're still one person. You can't really work on all things at once. So imagine for a moment that you are governor. If you had to choose those core issues that are facing our state, that are the non-negotiables, the absolute positive, this has to be done, what do those issues look like?
I just mentioned them. We start with the cost of living. That's non-negotiable. That has to be done. We have to bring that under control. We have to be able to manage that. Education is another non-negotiable. That has been on the table for how long now? Since the beginning of statehood. If you go back in the archives and you look at the old clippings, you're going to see that almost every election cycle, that was at the top of the list. There was always something to in regards to the educational system. And it always boiled down to this, accountability. They would always say, where's the accountability in our educational system? Who do we hold accountable for our underachieving students or, you know, the system that is broken? It's always been one or the other or both. In fact, in the last decade, or I should say the last couple of decades, it's been the system and the underachieving. So these are non-negotiable. They have to be done. And this is why I'm saying the direction that we've been going in for the last, 50 years is taking us down this path. And so what I've been hearing recently is this. How do you define insanity? You keep doing the same thing over and over and over, and you hope for another result. And that's exactly what they're referring to is the way that we vote. So, you know, Chad Blair, and I don't know what he said this morning, but he basically called it. He already said that Duke Iona has lost this race. Why? Because if you look at the historical data, if you look at historically how people vote in Hawaii, once the Democrats have that, you know, that trilogy, which is basically the unions, okay, and party, and 55 and over, they win the election. It doesn't matter what the substance is. All it matters is union, again, party, and 55 and over. And it's over. And so in their minds, that's all that's needed, and the game's over. So this is, I guess, one of the reasons why you have a lot of people who don't vote, because they feel like, what's the use? What am I voting for? This is why maybe a lot of people that we try to recruit to run as, you know, as Republicans don't want to run, because they're saying, oh, I've been told by the Democrats I should run as a Democrat and I have a chance to win. Here's a good example of this. Sam Kong and Robert Helsham are running, I believe, in District 33. That's, I think that's Mark Takai's seat. Mark Takai's seat. And Sam Kong ran as a Republican twice. Okay, this campaign, he switched and he ran as a Democrat. Ask him why he ran as a Democrat. His values are very conservative. He's a conservative. And he will tell you the only reason he ran as a Democrat because he was convinced by a couple of Democrats that that's the only way you can win. You can't win as a Republican. You have to run as a Democrat. He believed it. And so as such, he's running as a Democrat because he believes that's the only way he can win. Not because of his principles, not because of his values, not because of anything of substance, but just because of party affiliation. And this is what I mean by, you know, we're going down the wrong path and we have to change the direction we're going on right now.
All right. I want to ask you a little bit about education since you named that as being your first thing. You mentioned that you'd like to have an independent audit of the DOE. Mm-hmm. That issue has come up again and again. I remember asking Marian Higa about that when she was the auditor, and she said, you know, I would have to have so many more staff. We could only devote ourselves to only auditing the DOE, and it's going to take quite a long time. She didn't know that how they were going to be able to manage that given the staff that they had. And as with that staff, they were able to do only maybe a couple of schools a year. How can you have a comprehensive independent audit of the DOE, and what kind of cost are you looking at?
It'll be expensive, and it won't be a legislative audit. As you know, Marian Higa was the legislative auditor, and that's not independent. That I'm not going to say that those audits are biased, because most audits are not biased, even if done by the legislative auditor. But they are, how can I put, targeted. So they do their audits pursuant to the direction of the legislature. And I'm being critical, but I think I have a basis for this. Most of those audits that are done by the legislative auditor are done when the legislature feels that they're out to get something. It's a I got you type of thing for a department or an agency. And so they direct those audits. I'm talking about a completely independent audit, a private audit. We're going to hire an audit auditing firm to do it. It's going to be expensive. Someone put the estimate about almost $1 million. But I think it's well worth, not, I would say it's an investment, because we know for a fact that there's not only inefficiency, but there's waste. And I'm not trying to get anybody, I'm not trying to convict anybody or to have anybody fired, but we know that it's probably got a lot of fraud involved. Now, again, this is something that just happened while we were campaigning, but I think it was about a month and a half ago, a procurement officer with the DOE, and this person is very credible, has been with the DOE for a long time, was working on the Race to the Top program. And she was told to spend down money. She refused. She says, I'm not going to spend down. They told her again, spend down the money. She said, no. They said, okay, you're fired. They fired her. She's now filed a lawsuit. It's been public record. It's out there. She filed a lawsuit basically saying, you know, retaliation. This is just the tip of the iceberg, I believe, in regards to not only this inefficiency in regards to spending down money, but you're going to see how this process is flawed in so many ways and how we as taxpayers are not getting, you know, the value of our dollar.
So how would you characterize the DOE? Is it a sick institution?
I characterize it as an institution that is huge. The bureaucracy is huge. It has leadership that is really just focused on the top. They don't really know what's happening in the bowels, within the system itself. And as a result, since you have this top-down type of administration and direction, you have a lot of inefficiency and or fraud and or just, you know, just plain no accountability. So there's really truly a lack of accountability. And we've never had a complete now. Marian Higa and the legislative auditor has done, you know, these spot audits of the DOE. For instance, we had one in regards to the lunch program. We had one recently about the bus program, the transportation program. And what did they find? They found so much inefficiency and inadequacies and waste and in some instances some fraud.
And lack of competency.
Yeah, exactly. So as a result of that, what they said, we have a plan now. But now even that plan for transportation is not kind of panning out. Again, accountability, staying on top of it. And this is where if you have an independent audit, and it's not just going to be a fiscal audit, it'll be a management audit. I think it's going to be a tremendous tool for all of us because it will be independent. And it's an investment, as I said, and that's an estimate I got, about $1 million. They said probably about $1 million and maybe about a year.
And who gave that to you?
Oh, I was talking to some DOE, I wouldn't say they were officials, but they were part of the administration.
So this hasn't come from a company that's given you some sort of idea of what we would be spending on this.
But these are people who were involved with the DOE, who were part of some audits that they've had, you know, the spot audits they had with the legislative auditor. And that's the estimate that they gave me. They said, oh, it's going to cost about $1 million, and it probably would take about a year because they know the work that's entailed, like you said, for every school and as well as the administration.
I mean, a lot of people are hearing a year and thinking, maybe that's not enough time.
Maybe not.
When you're talking about that kind of a comprehensive
maybe
audit.
Not, but you know what? I believe it is worth the investment. Again, we've never had it. We've never had it done. And if not the way I envision it right now, then with leadership, maybe we can do something that would be maybe less time consuming, right? And give us a good indication of where we are at and what we need to change.
So let's talk about money and money spent in a classroom. You've said that you'd like to see 90% of every dollar going to in-classroom spending on students.
Right.
Given the budget, given overhead, given just electricity bills, is that really feasible?
Oh, absolutely, because we've never achieved that, and we know that that's the benchmarks that we got from the DOE. That's what they say they're spending. They said they're spending basically, you know, 10% of it is going, or in fact, less than 10% of it is going to administration. I think they said only 5% or 6% of it going. The rest of it, yeah. Now, when I say to the classrooms, I do mean that. I am including in that the overhead, okay? So it is about the electricity. It is about, you know, the water and all of that stuff. Now,
so what's the other 10%?
The 10%, the 5%, well, 10% is supposed to be the administrative cost. In other words,
okay, so you've broken out everything else,
yeah,
and lumped it into this is going into the classroom.
Right.
So that includes electrical bills,
right?
That
because
utilities
now,
and everything else.
Exactly, because now the principals can manage their own schools. In other words, they're not going to. Some of the principals will say, I want the administration to handle, you know, the transportation. I want them to handle the food, etc. But I hear so many principals saying, well, you know, as a result of that, I have no control, like, for instance, over air conditioning, how I can get air conditioning into my, you know, into my school. Because I got some parents out there or who are contractors or in the business who would donate a lot of that. But I got to go through procurement. I got to go through, you know, basically the board, you know, the administration. And as such, it's not going to happen. So that's what I mean by they'll have now the opportunity to basically – they'll be more they'll have more flexibility in how they want to use those monies. For instance, if they want to put more of it into, let's say, arts and sciences, they can put more into arts and sciences. They want more into, you know, some other STEM subjects, they can do that also. So it's really that opportunity that they would have. Now, if you remember Act 51, which was done, I believe, in 2004, in response to Governor Lingle's push to have local school boards, that was supposed to be the act that was going to be the answer, the holy grail. And it had the student-weighted formula. That student-weighted formula was supposed to amount to approximately 90% of the funds going to the schools, right directly to the schools. Right now, I believe it's only about maybe 57, 58% of the funds are actually going to the schools. David Ige, in his own platform, said, I want to get about 70% to the schools. I mean, 70%. I mean, that's not even what Act 51 says. It says 90%. So he's not even fulfilling the legislative mandate, you know, as it stands right now and as he proposes it.
So are you really saying that you'd like to see another look at decentralizing the DOE?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying the governance structure that I would have, you know, the remake would be, it would be what we call school empowerment. Now, the devil is in the details, but the structure would be such that you're no longer going to be what many principals call themselves, compliance officers. Everything comes down from the top. No, decision-making now will be at the school level. In other words, with the principals and with his faculty, etc. No longer from the top down. The top, which would be the Board of Education and the superintendent, they would have overarching, you know, I guess you could say decision-making or policy-making, overarching, but not the detailed, you know, curriculum, you know, teacher evaluation, et cetera, et cetera. That's where it would come at the school level.
It sounds a bit like the rationale for charter schools.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah, yeah, sort of.
All right, we're going to take some calls. People have been waiting patiently now. If you would like to join us, the phone lines are open, 941-3689, 941-3689. If you're on Oahu, that's the number to use. And from the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. Going to Anne calling us from Kapolei. Aloha, Anne, and thank you for your patience.
Hi. I actually had a different question from when I first called, but I have another one. You said in one of your ads on TV that you would have some kind of way to make it more affordable for housing for people, where you can rent basically to own almost.
Right.
The HOPE program?
No, I'm sorry?
You're talking about the HOPE program?
I believe so. I'm not sure what it was called, but I remember him saying something where you can... You're pretty much paying rent, and then you can start to own a home.
Rent to equity.
That's the biggest issue we have in Hawaii is that a lot of people who grew up here have to move away because we can't afford what people are calling affordable homes.
Right, right.
So what was your plan, and how can you help us?
Okay, well, let me just point out on my website, www.dukeiona.com, we have you know, all of the various platforms that we've laid out on our website in more detail and more comprehensive. You'll find HOPE on that. But let me explain that as best. It's kind of complex. So it's hard to say it in 30 seconds on a commercial, but I wanted to draw your attention
to
it.
Well, you got a little bit more time now.
Yeah, that's no, exactly.
Blessings of long format.
Exactly. So HOPE stands for Home Opportunity People's Equity. It is essentially a rent-to-equity program. It gives you, which we will call the community owner, an opportunity to save through your rent or to put into an equity account through your rent the amount that you would need and we would use for a down payment. You see, most of our middle income and below, and even some above middle income, I have, for instance, I have four children. My two oldest they rent. They're married. Their spouse. Their combined income, I think, is enough for them to qualify for a home, probably in the $400,000 to $500,000 range. But they just don't have. I don't think they'll be able to save for that down payment, that 10% down payment that most finance institutions are requiring now. We've had a revamping of mortgages, et cetera. So that seems to be the biggest obstacle.
Now, so can we put some real numbers to that?
Yeah.
Give me a scenario.
So we've been using, the model we've been using is a rent of approximately $1,500. And if you are paying rent at $1,500 after a period of 10 years, you'll have $45,000 in this equity account. Once you hit that, boom, you take that $45,000, you put it down as a down payment, and now you're out of that rental unit, and we kind of break that cycle, so to speak. Now, the other aspect to this HOPE program is the educational piece, because a lot of people in this bracket just aren't quite, I could say, I don't want to say smart enough, but they're not
financially savvy.
Yeah, financially savvy in regards to equity, in regards to home ownership, in regards to what a mortgage is, and for some, really what saving is all about. Because if they understand the true value of equity, then they will know that with that discretionary income that they have, and a lot of them have discretionary income, instead of buying that toy, whether it be a F-150 or that big bracelet that they want, they're going to put that money into their equity account because they know the value they'll get out of it. And the quicker they can build up this equity account, the faster they can own their own home. And knowing what equity is all about, they're going to see that, hey, there's more value to equity than there is for me just renting and throwing it away. So with all of that, they'll be able to, as you just mentioned, to buy a home and stay here in Hawaii. So it's a model that can be used right now. I have a partnership with Peter Savio, a local realtor and developer who I think a lot of people know. He's got some projects going on right now, right down the street here at the Pagoda, and he has some buildings that he's going to implement the day one when we get in. I said, I put him and some other people together, and I said, hey, give me a plan. We need a plan where as soon as we get elected, we can get people, you know, into homes right away.
And how many units would these be?
He's got some. I think he said he's got some at about 40, 50, 60 units, and he's got various buildings around the state. But this will be transferred to state. This model can be transferred to some of the housing units that we have, you know, with the state. Just as an example, right off the top of my head, you know, you can look at Camford Housing, you know, in Kalihi. You can even look at what used to be called Kuhio Park Terrace, but I think they've changed the name now. So some of these public housings, you can use this model. And, you know, because people in those housing units right now, the state housing units, they've been in there 30, 40, 50 years, some of them. And it doesn't turn over. And this is what we need to do. Now, Peter's not the only developer that would be, I guess you could say, I don't want to use the word brave, although that's what we tell Peter. He's just one of these social developers. But there's other developers that I know would engage in something like this. And in turn, you're going to have home builders out there who are going to build within this range also.
So what's their incentive? Because 40, 50 units sounds great for the 40 or 50 families that might get mm-hmm. them. But given our need and given our population growth, that's really just a drop
in the bucket. There'll be more. There's obviously more. I'm just giving you what he has available right now, or you might even have more. But when we talked initially, that's the number that I got from him, approximately. So the incentive, though, for the developer is real simple. One, he gets to help these people. He gives them hope to own a home. But more importantly, he still gets the value. He doesn't make, you know, he's not making, it's not out to make a huge profit, but the appreciation of the property, as you know, as it goes on, is a tremendous value to him. And also the fact that he gets a great tenant. Now he gets a tenant who he doesn't have to worry about paying rent, who understands the value, is going to be there long term. He's not going to punch holes in the wall. He's going to take care of the unit, because that's all the conditions to getting this equity. You're going to have to stay in it. You're going to have to maintain it. You're going to have to be, you know, prompt on your payments, et cetera, before you can get this equity. So there's other conditions that are a part of, you know, building this equity.
And just to be clear, if you're paying $1,500 in rent, how much of that is actually going into that equity account?
There's a percentage of it that goes into it pursuant to, like, sort of like a mortgage, the principal and the interest that you would be paying, right? So it would be probably the interest portion of it, the principal part of it, and then you build the equity that way.
All right. We're talking tonight with gubernatorial candidate James Duke Iona. The phone lines are open if you'd like to join us, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going now to Bill calling us from the Big Island. with apologies for a long time that you've been waiting. Thank you for your patience.
Okay, no problem. I'd just like to ask you why the state allows the Child Support Enforcement Agency to basically incentivize divorce and fatherlessness. After all, they get paid on a percentage of everything they collect from the federal government, and they are allowed to set child support rates themselves.
If I'm following your question, you're saying that child support, CSEA, has the ability to determine what the child support amount is. Is that what you're saying?
They do. In fact, they've taken it on themselves to reassess your child support every 6 months on their own volition without any input from the child support collector, and they get paid besides a pile of incentive grants from the federal government. They get one incentive grant as a percentage of everything they charge and everything they collect.
Okay, well, I think we have a different understanding of CSEA and the process.
I can give you that's in their charter. And if you can publicly announce that anything I said is different, I'd like to hear it.
Yeah, well, that's not my understanding. And if that is how it the process works, then I'm going to go look into it and get educated myself, because my understanding, and this is based on my experience as a family court judge for about 6 years in doing these types of cases, is that CSEA, Child Support Enforcement Agency, is just the administrative arm, you could say, of child support collection. They don't have the authority to set or to authorize any type of child support amount or payment. What they do is by law,
by the Child Support Hearings Office, which they absolutely do.
I'll tell you what, Bill. Because
I'm sorry, you're wrong there. And if you,
I'll tell you what we'll do, Bill. Hang on a second, because I don't want to have the whole conversation get co-opted by this particular issue, because we have a lot more issues that we need to cover over the next half hour or so. If you want to leave us your name and phone number, then we'll pass that along and you can have a conversation about that off air and see what the finer points are that you're seeing as opposed to what Mr. Iona has to say too. Okay, we'll leave it at that. I want to ask you about health care.
Mm-hmm.
We've had some real issues with health care and are continuing to. We've got a doctor shortage that's it's growing. Doesn't look like we're going to have a way of being able to abate that anytime soon. We also have a state hospital system in serious trouble. Many who access their health care through Medicare have a really tough time finding a provider. Whatever else happens, people are going to need health care. And we are, at the same time, trying to have everyone cope with the ACA. What do you see in Hawaii's future if suddenly you're governor?
Somebody asked me that question today in regards to why the shortage. And I can tell you just from my own, I guess you could say, engagement with doctors who are leaving right now, who are retiring early and or leaving the state of Hawaii and not practicing, it boils down to a lack of reimbursement, and two, administrative costs. In other words, what needs to be done to get reimbursement and, you know, file claims.
And their own insurance.
Yeah, and not getting the reimbursement, enough reimbursement from Medicare, Medicaid, et cetera. So as a result of that, what happens is these doctors are just, they're telling me that they're going to retire early. I've had several doctors who told me as a result of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, that because of the mandates that are now being imposed upon them as doctors, and mainly administrative mandates, and the reimbursements, the cuts in the reimbursements and where it's going to be, it's not worth it. And so they're leaving.
Right, and we've heard this from doctors before, because we've had some long conversations with some of them, and we've seen this shortage escalate, and the projections are it's going to continue to escalate, and whether or not there are going to be incentives or not to be able to bring them here, we're still talking about a long time before people are going to be able to feel like there's enough doctors for the population that we have. So what happens for you as a first step? I mean, clearly we're trying to get an ACA waiver, but what happens?
But the ACA waiver is not going to address those issues that you just talked about. I mean, the Prepaid Health Care Act has nothing, which is what we would have if we didn't have the ACA. That has nothing to do with reimbursements. No, reimbursements are still low.
No, they're still low. That's it. But at least people would be able to feel that they're being shunted down this path to be able to get insurance. You can have insurance, but if you don't have a doctor, it's not going to do you much good.
Yeah, but still, then you're talking about they can't get in. So, yeah, you have many doctors now who are not taking any Medicaid or Medicare patients because the reimbursement is too low. So that's in addition to just a shortage, you got another shortage of doctors who are here and practicing but just won't take those type of patients. And there's nothing I can do to force them to take them other than to hopefully can somehow have the federal government make the changes that need to be made so we can get more reimbursement or better reimbursement. I can work with the insurers. That's something that I could probably do as, you know, as governor of the state of Hawaii. But even that, I can only do so much. So it's really how we have to forge a not only a collaborative effort, but more of a, I guess you could say, a driving effort. And not just me. I'm talking about the entire, you know, the rest of the country and drive some kind of, and I think the governors can do this. I think if the governors get together and we put that kind of pressure and directive on the federal government in regards to what we're looking at, you know, from a state level with, you know, the low reimbursements and also, you know, the subsidies that are going to run out for us in regards to Medicaid. The ACA, and this is something that they haven't talked about here in Hawaii, and I can see why, because they're all proponents of the ACA, is what is going to be the cost to the state of Hawaii after this five-year period with Medicaid? You know that the ACA is geared to driving more people towards medical coverage. Nothing wrong with that. But they're driving most of these people to Medicaid coverage. And as a result of that, the subsidies that we're going to receive from the federal government right now, which is going to be fairly high, is going to run out, or going to be reduced to almost nothing in about 5 years. So that means in about 5 years, the cost of Medicaid is going to be levied strictly on the states. And that's going to be a huge burden on us financially.
And it's already a huge part of what the state spends for.
Exactly. So now this is something we have to deal with. And this is why we need to have some adjustments made with Obamacare, with the ACA. And that's what I mean. I'm hoping that we as governors can get together because, like I said, it's something that transcends party lines. It really does. And I believe that the governors are much more, how can I put it, they're much more collaborative than we have on the federal level. So I'm hoping that I can get together with my colleagues and we can do something about this because this is something that cannot wait. So you go back again to your first question, I believe, you know, say, what is a must in regards to what needs to be addressed? This is one. So you also mentioned about the Hawaii State Hospital System. That is a must right now. You know, we basically have people ask me, are we in good financial shape? In other words, you know, are we sound financially? I would say no. And I would say there's two reasons for that. One is the unfunded liability that we have, or actually it's the lack of pre-funds that we have for our retirement system, pensions as well as the medical health care. And the second is the Hawaii Health Systems Corporation. We have been bleeding in that for what, over 10 years. I'd say it's more like 20 years now, where almost every year it's about $50 to $60 million that they come in and ask for. You know, this year we've already got a request for $40 million, and we're not even halfway through this fiscal year. And so this is something that cannot be ignored. And there was, as you well know, there was a solution to that this past legislative session. But guess what happened?
Someone by the name of
Randy Pereira with HGA said, and this is his quote, he stepped in and he killed the bill. So that public-private partnership that we had that was on the table, that was poised to be passed by the legislature, and which, you know, David Ige did not do, it got blown up by HGA, the very union that now endorses David Ige. So how do we know that we're going to get something better this time around? Again, insanity. Doing the same thing over and over and over again and hoping for a different result.
We're going to go to some of the callers now. If you'd like to join us, 941-3689, 941-3689, or 877-941-3689. Going to Liz calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Liz. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi there.
Aloha.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi, I am very strongly pro-choice. I'm a pro-choice activist. I have heard Mr. Iona speak many times, both at the state capitol and at the University of Hawaii, talking about anti-abortion. And I've heard him, you know, talking about his religious beliefs and equating that with outlawing abortion. So, you know, I personally don't believe that we should have a governor that's going to tell women what they can and can't do with their bodies. So I'd like to hear you yourself clarify what your position is on that and what you're going to do to ensure women's access to reproductive health care.
All right. Thank you, Liz, for the question.
Well, first of all, I've never come out and said that I would abolish abortion and with that a woman's right to choose. Or, you know, God gives every woman, gives every person, a man and a woman, not only a choice, but also a free will to choose. So I've never said that. And second, it's an issue that's never been brought up in this campaign, not by myself, not by Ige, not by Hanneman, not by Davis. Nobody has talked about this. Thirdly, this is a federal issue. This is something that I have no authority over. It's an issue that was decided in 1972, I believe, or 73, by a Supreme Court case, Roe v. Wade. It was an interpretation of the Constitution. This is something that has to come down from the federal level. So yes, my position, I am someone who is who chooses life, and that stance will never change. And I've never said that pursuant to my religious beliefs or my faith that I would impinge upon a woman's right to choose. I respect every individual's a person's right to choose. I always have and always will. When it comes to women, this ad was nothing more than a strategy to distract from the campaign itself.
You're talking about the television ad.
Yeah. I mean, that's the only one that's out. Now, I think that's the one she's referring to. That's the only one that I know of that, again, to distract from the campaign and the issues that should be and have been, you know, being addressed at these 20 forums and debates that we had. Jobs, the economy, cost of living, etc. And as such, what it has is made it seem like I'm out of touch with women, that I have no compassion or respect for women's rights, etc. And nothing could be from the truth. I have a wife. I have two daughters. I have a granddaughter. I've worked with many, many women, not only on the bench as a judge, but also in my profession as an attorney. And I have nothing but the utmost regard and respect for women and my colleagues, whether they're male or female.
So some of these issues that are being put out there, whether you want them to or not, issues of gay marriage and abortion, all of those, you mentioned that you think they're a real distraction from the nuts and bolts. Do people not focus on that when they're coming from a very deeply religious perspective? Because those seem to be resonating with people, whether or not there's something that you would be even able to take on.
Well, again, it's a red herring, and that's not my ads. That's the, you know, my opponent's ads, and whatever their intent, and I'm presuming that's their intention when they run it. You know, because I'm obviously involved in, you know, in a campaign, and I know strategy on both sides, and that's what you try to anticipate. For our supporters, they take it in various ways. You know, some take it offensively, some it charges them up. They get more motivated to get out there and support the campaign because they believe that it's negative, that it's false, and that it's not accurate, and so they take it emotionally. My message to them always is ignore it. Just ignore those ads. Just focus on what we need to focus on, which is our message, our core message in regards to this campaign. And I just mentioned that.
So how about some of the fear that people have when they see you as a man of faith and they're concerned that somehow that's going to slip into the way you govern? I mean, you'd be surprised how many people have brought that up over and over again when we ask them what issues, and that comes even today. People were sending in notes about, well, I'm concerned about the religious aspect. How do you answer that?
You know, for one, again, how I respond to that is real simple. Like you, I am a man. Well, maybe you know, I'm a man of faith. I have these moral standards, this standard that I believe that I try to aspire to live to. What's right and what's wrong, and I would hope most people would want that to happen. Like many people, yes, I have a religion. I'm a Catholic, and I have my religion. But this is something, again, that is brought up simply because, I guess, because I'm someone who has that belief, and they wanted to say, you know, as I run for office, they want to find things that they can just drive wedges into. They've always used that as a reason for, and yet there's been no substance to it. So I ask you, you supposedly are someone who's been, you know, following my career maybe and following what I've done, is has there been any instance in which I have inserted my religion and my belief into any of my decisions that I have made as a judge and or as lieutenant governor, anytime?
I think only you would be able to say that because you're coming from that sense.
No, but I'm saying you're
you mean saying how transparent
you're inserting,
would that be?
No, you're inserting that into the argument. You're saying that people fear that that's going to be, you know, inserted by me into my...
I'm just telling you what we're hearing in terms of what people have said and what their concerns are, and how you align.
So I ask you that question, if that ever has happened, and it never has happened, and never will happen, because I understand, you know, what I need to do as, whether it be lieutenant governor, or as circuit court judge, or as family court judge. And I've always conducted myself in that way. So as a man of faith, like I said, I understand, you know, I have a moral standard that I aspire to live by, and I live by that standard.
All right. We're going to move on. Peter calling us from Waikiki. Aloha. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi. Thank you very much. My question is for Mr. Iona, and I'm a local dentist here in town, and I was wondering what his opinion is and if he plans on renewing the moratorium on foreclosure bill. It's decreased the volume of housing by 45% and reversed the trends of the market and made it very difficult for, you know, us young people who are trying to buy a home. And it's not very effective. It's very very frustrating for us. And I was wondering what his opinion on this, you know, in the Republican Party in general.
Yeah, it's not a party issue. It's what's best for the people of Hawaii. And, of course, I think that you raise a good point, and I think that's something that needs to be reevaluated. Obviously, you know, that's something I would have to work with the legislature on, and I think it's time for that evaluation right now. So you're absolutely right. I think that's something we need to look at. I think they just made an amendment to that not long ago. I know they got some data on it, and I need to get up to speed on regards to the latest data that they have in regards to foreclosures and how that's affecting the market, and more particularly to homeowners right now. So that's something I would look at, obviously, yes, and I would amend it accordingly.
Peter, thanks very much for the call. If you'd like to join us, there's still some time, 941-3689. If you're on Oahu, that's the number to use, 941-3689. And from the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. One of the big concerns that people have all the time is energy. But they're very concerned about the fact that we've been sort of told how we need to be greener, we need to get PV, all of this. And then, of course, last fall we had the moratorium that HECO put on anyone's ability to hook up to the grid because the grid really can't take it and you have to get permission, all that. And that's been a long story. But HECO itself, what is the way that you characterize HECO and how do you see it moving into the future?
You know, that is top of mind question with many. And when I identify the drivers for cost of living, energy is basically one of those drivers. We pay the highest, per kilowatt hour in the country. I think it's 38 cents per kilowatt hour. I think the rest of the country, the average is about 8 or 9 cents. So we obviously, you know, have a ways to go in regards to reducing that. In my opinion, over the last 4 years, we've kind of lost our way, or I should say, we've been a little stale in regards to really implementing the Hawaii Clean Energy Initiative. As you know, that was something that was not only created and implemented in the Lingo administration, but it was something that was historical. I mean, we have now, for the very first time, understood, I guess, because we really did as a state, as a whole state, understood that we had to get off this dependency that we had on oil. So we made a definitive move towards that with the Hawaii Clean Energy Initiative. You know, basically being 70%, you know, renewable and efficient by the year 2030. And we made tremendous progress in changing that policy. What we didn't have in the last 4 years is the kind of leadership that would say, okay, here's the overarching policy that we have. And the overarching policy or principle that we have is we're going to drive down the cost of energy. In other words, reduce the rate that the ratepayers are paying for energy. And we didn't direct the PUC to say, get this done. And we didn't tell HECO, get this done. So we need to be more affirmative in that. We need to have that driven by the executive branch. And we need to put the right people in the PUC, get the type of commissioners that we need in there that are going to be able to address that principle and move the dockets accordingly. Now, I understand that, you know, the PUC will need, you know, more resources, and I'd be more than open to giving them what they need, because these dockets that we have out there are moving a little too slow. For instance, you talk about this connectivity. I'd be open to this. I'd be open to suggesting to the PUC that in regards to this connectivity issue that we have, that maybe they should consider this. And of course, HECO would be a part of this, because it would be something that they'd have to address. Right now, the presumption is that anybody who has a PV on their roof, they have to do a study. They have the burden of showing that.
They have to get permission.
Right. And they got to spend the money. They got to spend the money on an independent study to show HECO that it can have connectivity. Well, let's reverse that presumption. Let's make the presumption such that you are presumed to be connected. And now the burden shifts to HECO. And HECO has to show you why you cannot be connected. They have the resources. They have the information. They should be able to do that within 2 weeks, even less. So those are the kinds of things that, again, comes with leadership and thinking, how do we move this along faster? Now, that's just one idea, and that's just one thought, and that's just one suggestion. I'm not saying that's where it needs to go, but this is the kind of leadership and direction you need in regards to where we're going to be moving, our PUC and HECO too.
So how do you direct HECO specifically and tell them that this is now how do you pressure them into doing
well
that?
Again, I'm the governor. I'm talking about policy. I'm talking about suggestions. I appoint the PUC. I can't tell the PUC what to do, but I'm expressing myself. I'm expressing the will of the people, basically, when I give these ideas or when I give these suggestions. And I've heard this, and it just goes to show you where we as a state have matured in regards to renewable energy. At a forum, the question was, should we have co-ops here on Oahu? Energy co-ops. Now, that's something nobody would have ever thought about even 7 years ago, or even know what that concept is all about. Now, it is a concept, but, is it, you could say, not only reasonable, but can it happen? I don't know. But I tell you what, I think if they're thinking about things like that, then maybe they can think along these lines also. Well, why don't we have community co-ops? Why don't we just let, the downtown Honolulu area have their own co-op? How about this then? Why don't we have another utility just for transmission and distribution? I mean, this is what's going on. These are the type of things, again, which is within the purview of the PUC and what they can and can't do. It's not my directive. I mean, I can't make that happen from the governor's office. But, again, being the leader that you need to have in this area and being proactive in mentioning things of this nature obviously will drive the direction of where we're going with energy.
All right. We'll take a few more callers if you want to join us. 941-3689, 941-3689. Or 877-941-3689. Going now to Ellen, calling us from Makiki. Aloha, Ellen. Welcome to Town Square.
Thank you. Aloha. Again, to bring it back to the religion, I've heard Elwin Ahu speak. I heard him speak at the state capitol during the marriage equality rallies that were going on. He has stated that one of the reasons he is running for lieutenant government is because he didn't think the people of Hawaii were respected in that, and that the Constitution was not followed. He's part of New Hope, which is a huge organization, and I don't think it's really fair to say that religion is not going to play a part in your governorship, because I do believe it will. I cannot vote for somebody who's biblical interpretations of the laws are going to affect the way they run the state.
Well, first of all, you're separating the LG from the governor. What do you have any particular criticism of Mr. Iona?
Yes, and I believe his position is the exact same as his lieutenant governor.
Is that a question or is that a comment?
It's a comment, I guess. But are you truly, because when you were a legislator before, you did push religious views, you were quite, you instituted prayers in the...
Oh, we lost her. Sorry about that. Don't know what happened with the line. But you want to just quickly answer her?
It's a comment. I don't know what the question was. Again, I think I've answered that. And again, we understand what the law is. Ellen and I are both former judges. We know what the Constitution says in regards to, basically bringing religion into government. We understand that. And we've never, ever violated the Constitution or, our mandate in regards to our roles and responsibilities as judges, as lawyers, and for me as lieutenant governor, and if I get elected as governor.
All right, let's move on. Eric calling us from the Big Island. Aloha, Eric. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi, how you doing?
Pretty well, thanks.
My question is about GMOs. We have 3 out of 5 islands that have moratoriums or some sort of legislation in the county, on the county level, based upon bad GMOs or against GMOs. And I'm just curious what the candidate's view on GMOs and big agriculture on the Hawaii Island, meaning Monsanto and DuPont and Pioneer, and having all the seed companies pretty much ship out industry to the rest of the country when we need homegrown agriculture and food to be grown for the people of Hawaii.
All right. Thanks very much for the call, Eric. So you've said that you prefer home rule. Is that really possible?
Doesn't seem that way in regards to the court's ruling on Kauai. So based on that ruling, I would assume that it would be a consistent ruling across the board, because I believe Hawaii Island also has a complaint I think they have a docket right now in the federal court in regards to this very issue. And my understanding was, I think they had the hearing already, if I'm not sure. So I'm kind of curious as to, what the ruling would be, but I would think it would be the same ruling. So, yeah, I would prefer it to be home rule in regards to, any issue regarding GMOs, but it seems like it's going to come back to the state. If it comes back to the state, then we're going to have to address this, whether or not we're going to have an anti-GMO ban or, any type of restriction. And that's going to – I think that's something that – I don't think it has the support in the legislature in regards to, that type of a ban. But for me, myself, I support all forms of agriculture. I agree with the caller in regards to the fact that, we need to diversify agriculture. I believe that, we don't have the kind of food security that we should have as an island state. 85 to, and it depends on what you're looking at, but anywhere from 85 to 90% of our food is imported. And we can do much better, and we should do much better. I think part of what the problem is that we really haven't when you talk about farmers, I don't know even know if we've had put the kind of emphasis that we need to have in our farming industry. I don't know if we've given them the kind of support that we need to give them. And I'm not talking just from, the government's point of view. I'm talking about from the community's point of view. I'm even talking about landowners who fail to identify important agricultural lands that need to be identified. So we can say, yes, we're going to make a commitment to diversified ag and make that move towards food security. So it's much broader than just saying, yeah, we just support agriculture and we're going to make it happen.
You've also said that you recognize the right to know what's in your food. How do you make that reconcile, or how do you reconcile that with support for ag, big and small farm?
I think everyone should have a right to know what's in their food, no doubt about it, what they're consuming. The question becomes now, we have to look at the economics of it all, the cost of it all, because it can be very detrimental to, some of our local producers. I mean, depending on what the mandate may be in regards to labeling, it could actually drive some out of business and or discourage them from even going into business.
So should that come from the federal government?
I don't want to say yes, but it appears that maybe, again, like, what I would love to have as local rule may be overruled. So I would say I don't know. I would like it maybe from an economic standpoint, it might be better if it came from the federal government. But again, my bottom line is always looking to what's best for the people of Hawaii.
Can we talk taxes just a little bit?
Sure.
You've talked a lot about the need to reduce taxes, increasing maybe the personal tax exemption. If you're able to do that, do you foresee that there might be a shortfall in what the revenue might be?
That's a good question, and that's very logical. But if we expand the economy with diversified agriculture.
But that's going to take time. So what happens in the bridge?
Well, I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, you got something right now that I'm very, very, very passionate about, and that's aerospace. Aerospace can happen right now. Huge infusion. I'm talking about today. I had our final forum was with the venture capitalists talking about technology, expanding that now. We can have that happen right now. But I mentioned something earlier, right? I talked about the inefficiencies that we have in the Department of Education. And it's not just in the Department of Education, but in all of state government.
So you're talking about slicing the pie a little bit differently.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, it's about cutting, you know, looking at all those inefficiencies that we have and the waste and maybe in some instances the fraud that we have. If we can cut that down, which we should be doing, we can do probably, I know, within the first year. And that includes the tax department. And, you know, there's a huge how can I put it? It's mismanagement, it's structure, it's organization, it's leadership. Turn that around right away, and we'll have the kind of infusion that we need to have so that we can offset that. Not only that, what you got to look at is that our government spending needs to be pared down. In the last 4 years, we increased government spending by over $1 billion. Government spending now. And so as a result of that, we know the economy was expanding and it was growing and we're getting more revenues because we only increased tax and fees by $800 million to balance that $1.2 billion spending increase. So we're doing well with revenues and we'll continue to do well. I think if we show the people of Hawaii as well as the rest of the world and America that Hawaii is open for business.
As you look at this campaign coming to a close now, is there a particular issue that you think that we didn't pay enough attention to?
In this campaign?
In this campaign.
Now, when you say we, are you talking about the candidates? Or
no, I'm talking about we in terms of people in the media, people in the public, things that you wish would have come out that we would have tagged a little bit better.
Thank you for that question, because yes, I do. I really believe that the focus was, again, on these, what I would call these red herrings, okay? You know, what's my faith? What's my belief? Whether or not we're going to have teacher furloughs again. I mean, those are all irrelevant and just not even a part of what this campaign was all about. This campaign really is about what happened in the last 4 years and where we're going to go in the next not only 4 years but the future generations. And that is about, again, this lack of direction that we're in right now. We are in total imbalance. Nobody really wants to address that. Nobody wants to just look at the facts. We have 51 legislators. Of the 51 legislators that we have, only 7 are Republicans. We have 25 senators. Of the 25 senators, you only have 1 Republican. You have no other Republicans in the county councils. You have no Republicans representing the neighbor islands. You have real interests, I mean, you should say special interests, such as the unions, doing things that Randy Pereira said he did.
Now, forgive me for interrupting, but we got a minute left.
Okay.
So.
And that wasn't covered to the extent that I think it's real. It's there. So people, what kind of choices are we going to make? Why are we always putting party before the people? And I've said that in numerous occasions that I will never put party before the people.
All right. That sounds like a good point on which we shall end. Thank you so much for joining
Thank
us tonight
you.
And for
Thank
the time.
You.
And we will see you after the election is over, and we'll take a look at what happened. Neil Milner will be here next week, and Colin Moore, and the three of us will debrief with you. Plan to join us next week for Town Square, and I'll see you tomorrow morning on The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Have a good evening. Aloha.